Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million. If I had
Hello, Mark Bay, Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamara Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 180. Yeah, 180. NASDAQ Futures up 847. Dow Futures up 1,200. As we seem to have this well-telegraphed ceasefire, as everybody started buying yesterday afternoon very suspiciously, and all of a sudden everybody did pretty well on that. But no, it's the market's way up. We hope, obviously, everybody's hoping the ceasefire holds and there's some sort of a deal over there where we and they stop killing people and wrecking stuff, because it doesn't seem like there's ever any really positive that comes out of that. But anyway, we'll hope for that. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing okay. What's up?
The market. Well, not oil. Oil's down. So if you're long oil futures, you're weeping if you're long oil futures. But if you have gold up, we got silver up. I mean, you know, everybody's celebrating here. I mean, and I think people knew about it and front run it. But it's okay though, because the Trumper I talked to the other night, disgustingly, told me that no matter how much anybody steals in this administration, they deserve it because of Pelosi. When I heard that, it made me want to go on.
I'm guessing it wasn't worded quite that way.
Oh, yeah, it was, because my question was worded that way. So no matter what they do, because of Pelosi, it's okay. Yes. Okay, then. You don't even really know what Pelosi did, though, did you? Well, I know she made a lot of money, and the news I listened to said she cheated. Okay, but we don't really have any evidence or any sort of thing on how she cheated, do they? Oh, no, I listen to good news.
Okay. There's a lot of tracking about the, mostly ran through her husband's account, but there's a lot of tracking about how the correlation of things coming before her committee managed to find their way into her husband's investment portfolio ahead of time.
Ahead of time of what?
Ahead of any announcements or any legislation.
So like last night, 1,000 points in the spooze.
No, just in
general.
Just every, you know, just time after time. I would have to, and I hate to be nonspecific, so, but I didn't come in prepared to talk about
it. Well, actually, we got better stuff to talk about it.
Yeah.
There is
very strong correlation of the personal trading and weeks ahead of legislation being prepared that would affect various companies.
How much? I actually read this once that, and I don't know the answer, and I don't think you do either. I read this thing. God, I think a listener sent it to me a while ago, Kevin. It said there were a couple of, and I don't remember if it was first Trump or Biden. It wasn't second Trump. It was a while ago. I don't know if it was first Trump or Biden. It said for the first time since, and I know, I don't know if there's been any of the laws, but I know it's becoming sort of a. Anyway, this guy said it hadn't really been since World War II that he could have been wrong, that companies were specifically referred to as suppliers in bills. And he thought that was a really bad thing. I mean, usually they would say we're going out for drones, and it's somebody's job to go out and get the drones, spec them out, go for auction, all that stuff. That very rarely were the companies listed. It seems like that's sort of happening again. I don't know if it's happening so much in the laws themselves, but we're seeing this specific stuff where Oracle's getting this stuff, or these guys are getting that stuff. Maybe I don't know. Maybe it's just that only certain companies can do this stuff now, which would not be good either. But anyway, that I couldn't. I don't know. I couldn't prove what the guy was saying or whatever. But the idea was that, you know, when you start naming specific companies, it means that the lobbyists, I guess, are doing a good job. Huh? Maybe not in your or my mind, but in somebody's mind.
So I'm not neither aware nor not aware, because I haven't read legislation that says so, but. It would seem very strange to me that you would name a qualified supplier in a bill. That,
yeah.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Now, I do know that, you know, because I work for the government, there is a process for qualifying suppliers, and if you want to be a supplier, you can actually apply to make the list of qualified suppliers. And there's a bunch of criteria that get specified as to how you go about doing that. And in fact, the federal procurement, we have a course in our, because we have a supply chain logistics or Department of Defense logistics credential that teaches it as one of the courses is the federal procurement process and everything that goes into that. So, you know, I haven't taught it. I was not a course developer, so I'm only tangentially aware of the content. But there are very, very specific guidelines for how that happens. Now, how they're executed and whether they're cleanly executed without corruption, well, it's the government. I tend to doubt that. But it's at least designed not to be a corrupt process.
Well, I know that there were a couple guys at Pullman that were really good at that, that was their whole life's thing, like managing government programs and procuring them. And we had one of those guys really helped us out on the CTA bid that we ended up not getting. The one I priced it out, but these other guys did all the work, really. And I didn't do the purchasing stuff. I mean, it was stuff that was going in the car and how much it cost. But, hell, I'd have been... get a weird-looking car if I'd have bought the stuff. But they had some guys that were really pretty good at that. Some of the... Every part of the government that does that stuff, roads and whatever, is they're all kind of different, I think. It's a career. But I know Audrey's cousin, he used to be in, I don't know what he does now, I haven't seen him in ages, but he was in the electrical business, and he would bid on these government jobs. And he said the trick is, if you're O'Neill something-something, substation, I mean, if you make, you know, some of the bigger parts that go into the thing, if it's written such that you have to use your parts, then you don't care who gets the job. You never have to actually bid for the job. It's like if...
You become a supplier to the supplier.
Yeah, it's like way back in the day, I would think that some of your biggest, whatever you want to call it, technical stuff would like demand an IBM mainframe or something, you know? So I know even if IBM doesn't even bid for it, they're part of it. You know, they specifically say you want an Oracle this or something there, you know, type of thing. But I don't know if you're familiar. I mean, did you ever run into that where the specific stuff they want in there was somebody else's, or you know, you're going out to bid for?
I have not. I would suggest that actually Mike Murphy might be a good guy to discuss this with, because he might have some insight into it. But I do. Guess at least, you know, educated guess at least, think that that there are such things, especially in defense, as preferred contractors. That if I need something, I need it now, and I don't have time to screw around, get bids and evaluating it. That you just go to one of the preferred contractors and say, let's have it.
Well, I know that even way back to my Allied Vandalized days, which is years and years ago, the guys went out and designed the tractors, meaning the trucks. They, you know, one guy, you know, would have a real bug up his behind to use a, you know, he wanted Cummins engine, and you can go out and get a Peterbilt with a Cummins or a Cat or whatever you wanted in there, and they would, so you would demand, and you wanted a Cummins diesel, and you wanted a Bostrom seat, and you wanted those kinds of things, so you named a lot of the stuff that was in the truck before you went out for bid, which happens. Hey, talk a little, a little bit about the Michigan budget, but I also want to talk a little about this guy on the Cubs that's got to go in for his surgery. So Horton,
yeah,
and you know, I I'm sure as hell not going to hold myself out as a somebody who knows a lot about physiology or anything like that, but there was a time, I wish I could get these, Kevin. This might be a job for Flanagan. The Tribune, for a period of time, back in the 80s, had somebody that wrote articles, and they gave the dude, back when, you know, he actually got the paper, gave the dude essentially the entire back page of the sports section to write on various things in sports that you would kind of, you know, a real deep dive into how people sprint, how pitchers pitch, even when there was one on how horses run, thoroughbreds, and how different it is from humans and the breathing and all that. But the guy was absolutely fascinating, to the point where if you read an article, you sort of had to remember it. And he did one on pitching and arm and people who have bad arms and so forth. And I remember it because he had the diagrams on there, and he named two pitchers. The reason why I thought it was so damn good, one of the guys was Oral Hershiser, and I forget who the other one was. It was a star pitcher of the same era. And the guy was talking about how the delivery of a baseball overhand, softball's different. I mean, I think you can pitch pretty much all day underhand, can't you, if you do it right. But anyway, I've never done that. I mean, obviously we pitched underhand, but it was slow pitch. But his point was, if you did it absolutely properly, you could pretty much pitch as much as you wanted. And he named the two people that were perfect were Nolan Ryan and Greg Maddux. And what the idea is when you come through with your delivery, you're from the tip of your, assuming you're a right-hander, from the tip of your right hand, if you draw a line through all the way down your arm, through your shoulder blades, to your other arm, which should be trailing perfectly, if you did that, and it was a perfect line, you weren't putting stress really on anything, that it was just like you would see, you know, would geometrically suggest, all the force was going in one direction, and you weren't. And he talked about people who went under. I don't remember. If you went under, I think you screwed up your shoulder, and if you went over, you screwed up your elbow, one way or the other. And Hershiser was one of them, and this other guy was the other, and they had not had any injuries yet. He said, look for this guy to have shoulder problems and this guy to have elbow problems. And sure enough, within the next 2 years, I think Hershiser, did he have shoulder surgery? Whatever he had, the other guy had the other. And these people that come up right now, you see these relief pitchers that are there to throw 25 pitches as hard as they can. Most of their deliveries are nothing near what this guy prescribed. I mean, and maybe for short-term shots you can do that, but I mean, Nolan Ryan and Greg Maddux pitched how many innings a year? And I noticed this when this kid Horton came up, throws the ball a million miles an hour. He's a great, great pitcher, but his delivery is horrendous. It bears no resemblance to what this guy says you're supposed to have done it properly. Now, Fergie Jenkins was kind of the same way. He's pitched batting practice between starts, didn't he? Just to stay loose. I mean, but this guy, I think this guy, when I first saw him, I said, they're not going to make this kid a starter, are they? I mean, he's all wrong for somebody who's going to go 7-8 innings. Sure enough, they did. I mean,
he was a starter his whole career. So,
but he also, this is his second surgery.
Yeah, well, tell me more about that, because I want to make sure we're on the same page.
I think he's already had a surgery once, and now he needs surgery again, as of yesterday.
Yeah, when he was in college, and it was, I think it was Tommy John.
Yeah, and now he needs another one, which is really awful, and he's a good guy.
Anybody gets Tommy John now. You know, that's your question when they draft guys. Did he have his Tommy John surgery yet or not?
Well, I think part of it is, I mean, I don't think people in the old days, we used to throw every pitch as hard as they can, but I don't think the principles are that different. And Kerry Wood, his problem was that when he was came out of the windup, when you land your foot forward, it's supposed to be pointing directly toward home plate, and his was not. He wouldn't come all the way through, so the last piece of his delivery forced him to come across his body more than he should have, yeah. which again wrecks your elbow. And when he came back from surgery, he never threw out of a windup again. Remember, he was always out of the stretch.
Yeah, in Horton's case, he did change his approach last year, and the big reason he did it was that they, because he had surgery in college and never pitched more than, oh God, I don't even remember what the number of innings was, but it wasn't anything approaching what a regular major league rotation starter will be. And he was going to be shut down at some point, just to make sure he didn't exceed his innings limit. So he started actually pitching to contact, not doing the max effort thing, because he wanted to stay in games. And he knew that they wouldn't let him throw very many pitches, and he didn't want to be a guy who was out of there in the fourth or the fifth inning. So he changed his approach to pitching and was actually pitching to get more contact rather than trying to strike everybody out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for the dude. I think, plus, the guy's really good. I mean,
He's really good, and they had to be shut down for the playoffs last year. You recall that?
Yeah.
So it's a shame. It's a damn good thing they traded for Cabrera, so they still have a front of the rotation pitcher there. So from the Cubs' standpoint, that will be a big relief.
Yeah, it's so who's the guy? This guy, they went down to see some guy in Texas. Is he now the ACL dude, and Tommy John, and rather than a guy in Alabama?
Well, there's a lot of people now.
I actually had a.
It's such a routine surgery now that they just really don't. I don't think there's the one guy where everybody goes anymore.
Well, actually, interesting story. I was needs an old thing, but I injured myself biking, right? And I had to get some surgery on my finger, which I kind of wrecked. And the doctor who did it said, this is somewhat like Tommy John. So we started talking. He was a talker, and so am I, obviously. And we started talking about it. He goes, yeah, the guy in Alabama, I could do Tommy John surgery tomorrow. He said, but I wouldn't. And I go, why? He goes, well, when a guy does it, there's usually five or six people. He has like this pizza pie operating room where the guys that are doing it, they're doing four or five at each time, and he's got a camera, and he zeroes in on everybody doing it. So he doesn't even do them really anymore. He said, but the whole point is his rehab people are the best, and if you stay there, it's so routine, they know just what to do. He said, it's nothing that I couldn't do. He said, but you're better off with a place where that's what all the rehab people do. The first week is they do the best stuff. They give you the best program afterward. Because it's the whole process. It's not just the surgery. And he says, those guys, that they specialize in it, and that's what they do. He says, doesn't mean that I couldn't go in there and be one of the surgeons tomorrow. I hope I could. I mean, I think I could. He said, but that's only part of the process, which I found pretty interesting. So there. So maybe this, the guys that do it are pretty famous. You're probably not going to go to your local guy to do it. You're going to go to somebody who does it all the time.
Well, you're going to go to one of the most reputable, but that's, anybody would do that if they could. But nevertheless, there are a hell of a lot of people who can do Tommy John surgery now. That's come out with stuff.
Well, some people you can. Where do they go get the ligament from? They always get it from the person, or do they go get it from a cadaver?
They get everything from cadavers now.
Okay, because they used to get it from you, I think. They used to get a piece of something out of your leg. I don't think they do that anymore. Anyway, what
next picture up from the minors at some point is likely to be Jackson Wiggins. That's another high draft pick who has come up through their system, is considered one of their top prospects now.
Well, good. I just hope this other guy ends up having a career.
Five,
I mean,
five, six, and I think he went to Arkansas.
No, we won't hold that against him, or will we?
No. We won't. Actually, Arkansas's got an excellent baseball program. So,
The people from the South seem to do better at that than the ones in the North, eh?
Well, it sort of helps to be able to play your games in warm weather starting in February, Northern teams pretty much have to play on the road for the first third of their season, and then even when they come back, it's cold.
Yeah. Hey, are you you still have to go to a lot of the Notre Dame games, baseball?
I don't think I went to any last spring, but I had my health issues last year, so I wasn't going to anything.
So you're back in the saddle this year, maybe.
I'm doing better this year, so I'm more likely to more likely to see lacrosse or something like that, though.
Hey, that's an Eastern game.
Oh, lacrosse is a really fun game to see.
I've watched a lot on TV. It actually is pretty nice. I didn't think I would like it, but I do. So.
Well, yeah, and I don't, you know, I've never taken the time to learn every rule, but it's an easy game to understand if you like games that involve a goal. So basketball, hockey, soccer, any of those, it makes sense if you understand that, because what's important in those games? Spacing is important. Every one of them has a variation on how you set a screen and what's a penalty and what's not. So, for instance, it could be called a nice screen in basketball, and it would be called an interference penalty in hockey, except that there are ways to get in the way in hockey with, you know, without committing the penalty. Well, those, you know, screen roll, give and go, all those kinds of things are, you know, they apply to every sport. And then the other thing is you have to get the ball, the puck, the, you know, the whatever, you have to get it to the place where you score, even if it's just to kick it back out for a longer shot. You know, you have to do all that stuff. And if you don't, then, you know, you're going to become very, very one-dimensional and easy to defend. So if you understand all the basic concepts of running basketball half-court offense, or, you know, hockey in the offensive zone, then you're going to sit there and watch lacrosse and say, okay, I understand how this game is played. Now, you have people running on and off, and people who can do things in the defensive zone that can't, you know, can't come across into the offensive zone, all that kind. There's all kinds of other rules like that, but you can enjoy the game. And the thing that surprised me is I understand that every sport is going to require some strength, a strength factor, but it is a bigger factor in lacrosse than I imagined it would be. I think I would have thought, before I ever years ago went to the first lacrosse game, that it would have been primarily about speed and strength would have been very secondary. These guys, it's very physical. How you can turn a corner against a defender, all those kinds of things requires an incredible amount of strength. And so, you know, that's one of my surprising insights that I figured out early on.
Well, basketball, same way. I mean, basketball is the same way. You think all people are doing a run, and it isn't. They're leaning on people. It's a huge strength game.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so it's kind of one of those dull moments when I'm sitting there going, well, yeah, of course it is. You know,
yeah.
I didn't expect it, but of course it is. You know, that comes into play. But that's something really, you know, it's something really nice to do when you have a 75-degree day. And so, you know, I'm sitting there going, yeah, I'd really like to do something outdoors today. Let me go online. Is, you know, who's got home game today? Could be the softball team, could be the lacrosse team. Doesn't matter. Let's see who's playing and go see them.
Hey, what up? We were jousting back and forth about the Michigan team, which Joel was all happy about. Obviously, winning the NCAA, and we were going
through. Still basking.
Oh, I'm sure he is. He went down. I mean, I hope he got some good seats. I know he didn't have seats when he got down there, but you pretty much can get them for the last game because people have the whole weekend. If your team lost, you want to go, right? So you don't stick around usually. But anyway, we went through some of the numbers that are being published. And the numbers that are being published are that the team was paid somewhere in the $10 or $11 million range. They got, what, three or four guys through the portal and a couple of guys they recruited last year. And then they have... They claim the budget for the department itself was about $14.5 million, because the coach makes like 4.6 or something, and then you got recruiting and all the other crap that goes with it. So you're talking $25 million now, Mike. Which brings up several questions, Kevin. One is, which, if somebody has an outside deal, is that part of the 10 or 11? I'm thinking the answer is no, but I don't know that. I mean, I don't see how, you know, Hannah Hidalgo's Red Bull contract could be counted in the money that Notre Dame gives the players. And plus, well, I think it's kind of high, like you mentioned.
Why I'd like the people who write the articles to be specific, because they're not, and therefore we don't really know what they're talking about. We don't know what's included in one part of the budget. So if you tell me the line item, if you're telling me the Michigan budget, I'm assuming that's dollars that Michigan pays. And And now my question is, okay, how much of those dollars go to the players? Because they, the athletic department has a limit. They can do, you know, they can spend all they want on staff, but they and that's coaches, that's trainers, that's, you know, heck, at Duke, they have somebody who is in charge of players' brand management. That's the person who helps them get lined up for all of their independent earning opportunities, who does all the coordinating of that.
Well, I think that's so, supposed to be the 14.5, according to this article.
Well, and the reason I say that is because the school is limited, in according to the court settlement that they had last spring, the school is limited to spending directly on players $20.5 million. That's all of their athletes. How much of that do you suppose goes to the football program?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
Well, it ain't half. It's probably three quarters or more.
It could be. The reason why I ask that.
And that doesn't leave a lot for the for basketball players, men's,
women's. I don't know.
Doesn't leave a lot for their hockey team, which is really good too. You know, so now you start saying, okay. So what does that budget number really mean? Is that budget number like the 16 people that Duke has on staff, player development people, operations coordinators? They even have Jason Tatum on, but he's not paid, as a chief basketball officer, so I don't count him among the 16. Chief basketball officer, his role is just basically to do some experience stuff, some professional development for the players, and to bring his NBA resources to the fore. But all these other things are all part of their commitment to basketball success. Now I look at Notre Dame, and they have half of that.
Okay, but I guess to talk about what's included, that's kind of what I'm digging at here, is the number appears to be, from two of the Jamokes on TV and looking at this Michigan number, it looks like virtually every team claims they paid out 10 to 11 in NIL. The one that was actually higher was Texas, and they weren't as good. Well, they did it pretty well.
Once again, how much of that $20.5 million do you think Texas sent to its football team?
That's what I'm trying to get to. As I'm saying is, if the other stuff, the stuff done by other people, is not counted, it could be that you have all the people on the football team are being paid not through the school, through these other things. In which case, the football, they might be paying these kids $50 million, but only five of it might be counted from the school. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, and we don't see the breakout there, so it's hard to say. Now, what happens during the recruiting process, whether they're recruiting people for transfer or whether they're recruiting people out of the high school? They promise them a certain amount of money. So they actually are supposed to have, or not supposed to, but they do have people whose job it is to line up endorsement opportunities and have them at the ready, so I can promise this guy who's transferring from, one of the starters at Michigan is from Illinois, so that last spring when they're doing the recruiting, I can promise him, here are these endorsements you're going to have that are worth, you know, $500,000 to you, $700,000 to you. I have them all lined up. I am offering you that, but I can't really put it into the clearing process, the approval process, until you sign on with us, and then we say, okay, here are the deals, I have to get them approved. And that's a problem some schools have encountered, because they have promised some of these endorsement deals and they haven't been approved, and now they have to scramble and say, geez, I better find something else for this guy, because I promised him $500,000 and I don't have a $500,000 deal to give him.
Well, there must be ways around this. Imagine that, Congress and stuff screwing the thing up. There's got to be ways around it, and executive orders and other stuff, because the people that are trying to raise money for Marquette, that's the number they're trying to get, $10 million. I don't think the people writing the check expect half of it to go to women's softball. I mean, they're raising money just for basketball. So there's got to be a way to keep some of this money separate from what the schools actually pay people. And if they've got a bazillion dollars in the football team in another pot, maybe they are capable of giving the basketball team $10 million, where you can actually promise a guy coming through the portal, you get here, it's $1.5 million, and we're writing the check. And you don't have to do anything. You don't have to show.
Marquette probably can promise the $10 million to the basketball program because they have the same $20.5 million constraint. They don't have football.
I guess what I'm saying is maybe even Michigan has so much other money for football that they actually, if you're getting somebody through the portal, it's sort of like when Audrey goes out to bid for a house. You got a cash buyer, you're stronger than somebody who's got to go get a mortgage, right? They probably can get a mortgage, but it's not, it's not the same. So maybe when you get somebody coming through the portal to say, look, you're getting $1.5 million from us. We're not, you don't have to throw them, go make commercials. You don't have to show up at Pete's Pizza or anything. You're just getting paid $1.5 million. I'll bet that's a pretty serious marketing advantage to be able to just do that.
Well, I think it is. I think that puts the Big East schools in interesting, it gives them an interesting advantage that others don't have. And yet they still are scuffling because, you know, you still have to come up with that budget money for the rest of everything. There is, you know, we can go back to the Jerry Krause thing about organizations winning championships. Yeah, you need the players, and there's no doubt about that. If you don't have the players, you're not going to win. But you do have to have an infrastructure there that is built around how do I help all of this be successful. And they have to spend budget money on that, but that doesn't come out of that $20.5 million. That's just, and so I don't know if Marquette is trying to raise money for $10 million just for basketball players. That goes into the university coffers and then comes back out and goes to the basketball players, or if it's $10 million, you know, I know Duke has a lot because I've read some articles about what they do, and they try not to discuss it, but you know, they pretty much go to Shire and say, "What do you need? What yeah. do you need?" And some of that is money for the players, but some of that is, you know, well, I do need to have the following kind of staff members funded. So that we can be successful at all aspects of what we do, and so that's part of their commitment, and I just don't see how you get around them. I will also tell you this: when we look at that $20.5 million and how Notre Dame works, I know there is some part of it that does go to men's basketball. The lion's share goes to football for sure. But there's parts of it go to women's basketball, that go to hockey, that go to all of that. So, I can even think of, you know, we're not talking about just Hannah Hidalgo. And you know what it was, the team this year was Hannah Hidalgo and her sisters, basically. The number six, number seven player on the team got something. I don't know how much it was. I don't know if it was $5,000, $10,000, $30,000. I have no idea what the amount was, but I know every last one of the regular seven players on that team had something from the university.
Well, I think one of the articles I dug through said UConn was in the $20 million range. They were real high.
No, and if UConn was in the $20 million range, well, that means they paid virtually 100% of their available funding directly to the players, if that's how you interpret it.
Yeah.
That's why I say I need to see a breakout of this. How much is direct from the school, how much is indirect? When you talk about the budget number, how much of that is going to athletic department salaries, athletic department expenses, and how much of that is going into some of the funding for the players? And without any kind of breakdown on that, I don't think we can draw any conclusions about.
Well, do you think they make money?
Who do I think makes money?
If Michigan's number is $25 million, do you think they're making dough? Or they probably did because they won. But what about other people?
They'll make a certain amount because they won. So they're, you know, and were they selling out their arena? Pretty much, yeah. At least through the conference season. So there's a lot of ticket revenue there. And there's the Big Ten's got a really, really good TV package, so they're going to get their share of TV money, whatever is allocated out of the package to basketball. So, yeah, I think they can make money.
What about, like, the rest of the places? What do you think Notre Dame makes? I don't think Notre Dame makes $25 million worth, do you? Maybe they do.
I think in the past they have been at a point where they were profitable, but I doubt that they were profitable this year or last. They're just not getting a lot of ticket revenue. So basically, the big revenue item for them is their share of ACC money, and the ACC has just gone and diluted everything with its expansion. There is nothing additive about the teams that they, you know, the West Coast teams that that they put in there, that they allowed to come into the conference. They have only diluted the pool of media rights.
What do you suppose the new upshot, well, not upshot, but the WGN here in Chicago, they're not really Chicago anymore, but they're finding a way to put some of these local stations on more often. The Irish were on there a few times, and they were on... now, is that part of the ACC package, or is that something...
Yeah, that's ACC syndication. So, you know, essentially... They have, network gets first dibs. So, you know, ABC will get first dibs on some of their games. So they're going to grab like Duke and North Carolina, those, you know, some of the bigger games. Then the cable networks, your ESPNs and ESPN2, et cetera, they're going to, you know, even ESPNU are going to get next dibs on the games. And, you know, when you have a huge conference, there's a lot of games. Then after that, it's who, you know, what's going to be on the ACC network. And then after that, any games that are left over become part of the syndication package, and they will offer those out to networks. And so the big one that has bought up a lot of ACC games is CW Network.
And that's what Channel 9 has become.
That's what WGN is. Morphed into.
All right. What it seems like the money is flying around so much, Kevin. You hard to imagine if we go into some kind of a recession, how this is all going to settle out, or to some people. I mean, it when you talk about how the economy's doing, and everybody depending on your, you know, who you listen to. But the thing that's bizarre, I always go back to, you know, what I've read about the 20s. Obviously, we weren't alive. But the idea that some people had so much money and so many people didn't, you know, so the entire agrarian part of the population, which was about 50% at the time, was in a depression. A lot of other people were already in a recession. And I just noticed that the cost of a Model A, it's seeming like we're getting sort of the same sort of thing now a little bit. I don't know how you quantify it. Model A was like $450 to $500 bucks. The Duesenberg was $15K to $20K. So if you bought one Duesenberg, it was like 40 Model A's, right? You know, like now we talk, I joke once in a while about, you know, one yacht is worth how many bass boats, right? I mean, it's really pretty hard to get any kind of, Russell and Larissa, hopefully both later, it's really hard to get some kind of a gauge on how the economy's doing, because a lot of it is this wealth bubble, which is stocks and houses. Commercial real estate, I don't know if it's part of the wealth bubble anymore. I'm thinking it isn't, Kevin, especially in some of these cities. But you wonder what is going to happen if interest rates creep, and even though there's a ceasefire, which of course the vice president came out today and said it's a very shaky ceasefire. Does that mean he wants to sell his stock and go short here? I don't know, but I don't know what that even means. I mean, everybody's celebrating the fact that there is a ceasefire, and the guy's already thrown cold water in it. So now, you know, the question is it something that if the Defense Department budget and all these other things rack up next year, and there's either going to be more borrowing or more money printed or more taxes of some kind. I don't know that that's necessarily good for the economy, but today, obviously, everything you did to the upside is right now you're fat and happy. I mean, we've got, you know, 3.5% moves in the QQQ. That's I don't think I've ever seen that to the upside. I mean, we're up, you know, $20 in the QQQ. We've gone years where things didn't move $20. And volatility sometimes is good if it goes your way, Kevin, but it's also kind of a sign of kind of a crummy market fabric. And I kind of noticed it last night. I mean, yesterday afternoon was one of the oddest days watching the market. You know, we're trading it for people, obviously. And you try and put something out there, and I mentioned to Dan, I go, we cannot have a standing order out there because we're just going to get picked off. If you want to sell something or buy something, let's just do it. which normally we don't, because the markets also, when it gets like this, the markets want to spread out. So if a market could be 50-75 or something on some call you want to sell, normally we'll offer it at 65 or something, somewhere in the middle. And I'll use the term regular days, which there aren't any anymore. You know, somebody doesn't want you in the middle, and if you got a 20 lot for some client or a 10 lot, chances are you'll get filled there. It's not an order that anybody wants to sell. It's not something that Robinhood wants to do, but it's something we do for people because, you know, we're good at this. Well, now yesterday, you don't want that, because if you're offered at 65 cents and it seems like a decent deal, if all of a sudden they declare peace, your 65 cent offer is gone. It's going to come out $3 bid, because there is no market fabric of any kind. There's no standing orders to where if all of a sudden that announcement comes out, everybody's got an offer out there is going to pull it, which is what's happening here. I mean, it's as soon as this started to go, everybody's offer got pulled. So if you needed to buy some futures or buy some Qs or whatever, if you don't pull your order and you're just some schmuck making a market, which used to be like a real job, somebody runs right over you, and now that person is now a buyer because they just got it stuck where the sun don't shine. So it's really dangerous to be some kind of a trader unless you have calls or puts behind you. But then again, if you have calls or puts as insurance the one way or the other, you're paying for those, because yesterday the VIX was 27 and now it's like 21. Okay, so the cost of insurance today is going to be cheaper than yesterday. But it's really kind of bizarre when you're sitting around knowing some. It's almost like an earnings report for the market, where you know if there's an earnings report for a stock, things going to dash one way or the other. You just don't know how far. Well, same thing as yesterday. I mean, the idea that we're going to bomb a country that they're trying to save back into the Stone Age, or everything's going to be okay, is kind of an interesting fork in the road, wouldn't you say? There's not a whole lot of middle ground there. And now, I don't know, is 20-day ceasefire? Does everybody think that everything's going to get wrapped up in 20 days? I mean, I sure hope so. But I don't know, Kevin. I don't know if I'd handicap it at all, would you? I mean, how would you handicap it?
Well, no, I think the vice president is correct. I would say, it's shaky, so we have something. Let's just take everything at face value. We have a framework for an agreement going forward. We're starting to move. You know, part of the ceasefire for the time being was based on movement of more shipping through the Straits of Hormuz. This morning, the reports are that's happening. At least that's what Maria Bartiromo was claiming this morning, and said they had reports of that. So okay, I'll go with that. And so, okay, it's shaky because how much do we trust the Iranians? How much do they trust us? How much, you can start asking a lot of questions. What's the track record on agreements with Iran? Not very good. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be skeptical. But hey, if we get this done, cool, good. I'm glad. That'll be a good thing. We'll wrap it up. We'll start, figure out how to monitor things and then just move on from there. I would be real happy if that were the case. I just don't, I'm not going to bet my bottom dollar on it, though.
Are you going to tell Netanyahu to stop killing the guys you're negotiating with?
Well, that's a problem. And, what I tell you before, was a quote out of out of an article that actually was in Axios that was citing an insider who said Israel likes chaos. Chaos is to their benefit, but it is not to the benefit of the United States. And this is where the two countries differ on approach. I my observation way back at the beginning was that, Israel's and the United States' objectives in this have some overlap, but they're not the same.
Well, it's at some point you wonder, and I don't know what's going on in the Middle East stuff. I mean, Mike probably has a better idea than me, Mike Murphy, but it seems to me that a lot of what Israel's doing is there's a lot of hatred going on in that area, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that have family members dead on both sides, so I don't know how you put all that together. At least in the American Civil War, when it was over, everybody turned around and walked 200 miles in the opposite direction, right? So you probably didn't come close to anybody that you were fighting against. But over there, that's not the case. But this constant, well, the guys from Lebanon are pissing us off, so we need a buffer zone, so let's take half of Lebanon. You kind of wonder who started that, Kevin, when the one side always ends up with more property. I mean, it's very suspicious to me, and I don't know enough about it to accuse anybody, but it just seems like it always happens one way, and then the result is always one side gets more. And it's pretty scary.
We're running a different playbook now, though, than past U.S. policies have been. And did you read the National Defense Strategy that was published last year that I sent you a couple of weeks ago?
I probably read part of it. I've got so much stuff, but what is it? I mean, who writes the strategy? We're firing all the people.
What are you talking about?
We just fired the generals. I mean, who writes the strategy?
That's cabinet level material, yeah.
All right, well.
So, that's driven by Trump. I don't ever recall any other administration actually publishing such a document, and it's pretty comprehensive, and it speaks specifically to defense strategy in each region of the world. So there should be nobody who has read that document. It was published in late 2025. There should be nobody who's read that document that should be surprised by anything that has happened in the last.
Well, how many more countries are we going to bomb if I read the document?
Don't shift to that and let me finish the thought. Now, I was about to say. You might read it and say, I agree with it. You might read it and say, I disagree with it. You might read it and say, I am appalled by this document. But what I'm telling you is, if you're surprised, it's only because you decided that you didn't want to know what the strategy was.
Okay, what is it? How many more people are we going to die? Are we going to bomb?
Tom, don't give me that, because that's not the relevant question to it. If you want to discuss it, if you really want to discuss it, read it, and then I'll talk to you about it.
Okay, but I'm getting tired of killing people. Is that a?
That's fine. But if you want to discuss the whys and wherefores, then read the damn document. It's only about 30 pages.
Well, let me ask you the summary. It means
if you want to discuss it, I'd be glad to discuss it. But I'm not going to discuss it if you don't want to be informed about what the thought process is behind it.
If we don't like somebody, do we have the right to use force? That's my concern. Is that what it says?
I don't think that's what it says.
Okay, well, then I would appreciate it better than if I thought I might appreciate it. Okay. We're doing all this stuff to corral China. I don't see China bombing anybody. I mean, I never thought.
There's a whole section on the Far East and dealing with China.
All right.
You want to talk? I'd be glad to discuss it, and I would encourage the listeners. It's the National Security Strategy. You can just go look up, in any search engine, you go National Security Strategy, United States. I think it's December 2025, if you want to put in the date in there. And it's published. It's totally transparent in terms of what.
Well, do you agree with it?
There are parts of it I agree with. There are parts of it I don't agree with.
Give us an example of each, if you would.
Let me see. An example of each. As far as the Middle East, the big thing is they want to ensure that Gulf energy supplies do not fall into the hands of an outright enemy, that the Strait of Hormuz remain open, that the Red Sea remain navigable, and that the region not be an incubator or an exporter of terror against American interests. I agree with that. Do I agree that translates into we should have gone into Iran? I don't. It also says, and I agree with this, we also have a clear interest in expanding the Abraham Accords to more nations in the region and to other countries in the Muslim world. I think that's important as well. Now we can go look at Asia, and they want to rebalance America's economic relationship with China, prioritizing reciprocity and fairness to restore American economic independence. Yeah, that's okay. Second, if the United States must work with our treaty allies and partners, who together add another $35 trillion in economic power to our own $30 trillion national economy, together constituting more than half of the world economy, to counteract predatory economic practices and use our combined economic power to help safeguard our prime position in the world, etc. I mean, this is, you know, some of this is lengthy. Yeah, I think all of that is fine. But then, the Western Hemisphere, the same thing. There's some stuff in there, but a lot on the Monroe Doctrine. And you really should read it and see. But, there's a whole section on Europe and, how we are dealing. And that all came up at Davos. You know, everything in there that they discuss in Europe was stuff that were in the various speeches at Davos. And I think that's important to recognize that, there's a consistent context there. So, that's the kind of material that's in there. There's some stuff about Africa and wanting to transition from an aid-focused relationship with Africa to a trade and investment-focused relationship. Those kinds of things, I think, are all fine. How that translates into military action is a very, very debatable issue. But unless you understand what the goal is, then it's pretty hard to debate what's appropriate.
Well, I would probably agree with a lot of those goals as well, but I don't know the stuff in the Middle East. It's hard to, and I'm no fan of Iran, obviously, but it's hard to counter that with the idea that Israel gets to do whatever they want, and that guy's a problem. I think
one of the interesting things about the Middle East strategy in there is Israel does not have an elevated position in it. Israel, as it documents allied countries in the Middle East, Israel has no more favored position in that, and that this is intentional wording. They're very precise with their wording. Elevation compared to the Emirates, the Saudis, people like that.
I think they went off their script the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
Well, I think they had overlapping goals, but I think there's been a lot of pushback. Every time Israel goes too far, you have seen the Trump administration push back on it. Another one that's in there regarding the Middle East is we want to prevent an adversarial power from dominating the Middle East, its oil and its gas supplies, and the choke points through which they pass while avoiding the forever wars that bogged us down in the region at great cost. That's speaking to Iran. That's also speaking to the Chinese.
We've always felt...
adversarial power, and they're saying, we are not going to let you gain influence in that area any more than you already have, which they certainly have with Iran and a few of the other states in that part of the world.
Well, I mean, I like our flag a little higher than the Chinese flag, but we started sticking our ass over there the day oil was found. Why do we think it's our oil? And we've always acted like it is.
Actually, they were pretty specific about saying in this document, they're pretty specific about saying we have plenty of oil. And this is the same thing you've heard them say publicly. So we have plenty of oil, but we want to ensure free flow of oil out of that region.
We also have heard him say
we care about that because we care about the pricing of oil on world markets.
Do we want it higher or lower?
I think we want it lower.
I don't know who the we is in that.
Well, in the United States, I think the we is us, because if you're trying to onshore more manufacturing, then you want you don't want high fuel costs.
An awful lot of people and a lot of power want it higher.
If you want to build plants, you want your fuel costs to be as low as possible.
Well, I think
you need the economic model for building manufacturing plants in the United States to be very good.
Well, if we think that Russia is one of our enemies, we just did more for them in the last 8 weeks than they've had anybody do for them in the last 20 years, raising these oil prices this high.
Yeah, I think so, and I think I actually heard Bessent talking about that a few weeks ago, as he discussed it, he said, we don't like it, but at the same time, I'm trying to think of exactly how he worded it, Part of it was that it's temporary, and we'll see. I don't think it's just going to drop like a rock. I think it might slowly climb back down, but but I don't think it's going to just drop like a rock. The I think you will find that. What was I going to say? Now this is old man moment.
It's all right. We all get those.
Yeah, I know. That basically, I think what they're really saying is that while Russia may be a beneficiary on this, that there's a greater good type of thing.
That's when you should say. See, this is why you like coming. Not, that's when you should say there is so much stored up there that maybe you don't have. That just takes me a little more time once in a while to access it.
Well, that's probably true.
Right, I'm not lying to you. It's probably true. takes a little while to access it, right?
Yeah, well, plus I've been screening course material for the last.
When you were 25, you got it quicker, but there wasn't as much up there.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm screening some course material, and if I'm going to foist certification exams on students, I have to take them myself. I've never loved test taking. So.
Oh, I know. I just, this thing about the oil, we can have various administrations say whatever they want. But the simple fact is, from day one, we've thought that the oil over there was really ours. I mean, or our access to it or whatever. And I don't believe the part that we are that much energy independent here, because we're not. I mean, we are for a while, but we've seen the North Shore drop. We've seen the stuff in North Dakota drop, and now we're seeing the stuff in Texas starting to creep down a little bit. It's not that we can't find more, but as it's also the nicest thing, Kevin, if you can buy it from somebody else, because it's not like oil is recyclable. I mean, you burn it, right? So if we can buy it from somebody at a decent price, guess what? We have more here, right?
Well, and you will, there's a market there. So we may produce enough for the United States to use, but some of that gets exported, and we backfill that with imports from other places, depending on the logistics involved, because sometimes it is cheaper to be bringing something in on the East Coast and exporting out the door on the West Coast than it is to try and get something across the country.
As long as I've been involved in talking about this stuff, which is a long time, plus, we did talk about some of it in school a long, long time ago. The thing, I've often sort of wondered is our management of natural gas has always been horseshit. I mean, when we built the pipeline in Alaska, which was a big deal, obviously, right? For years, they just flared the stuff off, natural gas on the North Shore, and just basically wasted it. There was no attempt ever to, because even the last few years, it never got built, because I read a bunch of studies somebody sent me from the show about putting a pipeline from the North Slope so to get gas in the Midwest. Well, the easiest way to do it would have been to build a pipeline in Canada to connect with their pipeline, which actually does come to the Midwest. But the Alaskan governor, and I don't know who he was, Democrat, Republican, it wasn't, what's her name, Sarah Palin, was like after her, I think, said, oh, no, we're going to build it here. And he never got it done. So there never was one. I mean, all your government vehicles, the vans and all the other stuff in Washington, for sure, that never really leave the area, they should all be natural gas. The concrete trucks here that Ozinga was building for a while, they were all natural gas. And now, I think that whole thing fell flat. I mean, I don't get how we've, natural gas, we can talk about oil. The U.S. is awash in natural gas, and always has been. And we've managed to waste it, not use it, not have any infrastructure for it. There was on Elston Avenue by me, there was actually a natural gas filling station. It's closed. And then there was one up on East Coast.
We don't do that gas vehicles, and I don't know why. It doesn't make sense. The bus system in South Bend all runs on natural gas. The guy who was here when all of that converted decided that we needed to go electronic. We've de-emphasized certain kinds of manufacture, whereas I look at natural gas and say, it's a cleaner burn. If you really want to, a cleaner, better air quality and so on, that natural gas is a nice step in that direction. And yet we have totally squelched it. I don't know if that came from the auto industry, from the oil industry, from the green industries. I have no idea who was behind that. But boy, natural gas somehow became a dirty word when it came to.
And I don't get that. I don't get that. Remember, you're old enough. And I don't know, you weren't the Chicago boy. Well, I was in Evergreen Park. We were sort of in Chicago. Remember those old buses, the flexible coach buses, the big bobbers?
Yeah.
Those were all propane. And all of a sudden, whoever made the propane engines decided on their own, bought out, it's before I was this conspiratorially, all of a sudden everything was diesel. Well, why? Those things were cleaner. They work fine. Why did we have to go to diesel all of a sudden?
Yeah, makes no sense. Considering that it's, you're battling this whole, green agenda there and, what's going on with that, I know they're against fossil fuels completely, but when some fossil fuels have a cleaner burn, I would think that a step in the right direction is a good thing.
Oh, it's an incredibly cleaner burn.
Being ever so crazy.
It's an incredible, the funny thing about California is they like to, or as everybody likes to rag on California, especially Republicans, but California deserves to be ragged on. But you know who had, and I could ask this question, and nobody'd ever get it on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, who had the single best electric streetcar system in the U.S.? Nobody will say L.A., but it was L.A. It was, and General Motors did some kind of a back in the 50s or 60s, probably 50s, some long story. Now, when you say streetcars in Chicago, okay, most of your streets, the bus lines were streetcars. But in Chicago, they pretty much sucked because they were combined footprint. So it would go down the street, but oh, by the way, the cars could cut in front of it and all that kind of stuff. So if there was a traffic jam, the streetcar couldn't go anywhere any faster than cars. I think almost all of it in L.A. was segregated right away, which is really the cat's meow. If you could have that, it's the best thing on earth because you could have a million cars all jammed at a red light and a streetcar goes right through. They tore all that up. They tore it up after putting it down. I mean, we're not talking about just stopped using it. The cars were torn, were taken, and they were like shredded. There's pictures that you could probably find on the internet of all these things all stacked up. They just wrecked them all and decided to go with diesel buses. And General Motors is the one that essentially put forth that study. It was sort of like Harvard University's stupid study that you were breathing air in an airplane during COVID was better than walking outside. Anybody who believes that, Kevin, could there be anybody dumb enough to believe that?
At this point, can there be anybody dumb enough to believe anything about COVID?
Well, yeah, but I mean, really? Really? The guy next
Remember,
to me is
he told people that you were okay if you could stand 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
So, but start thinking back of all the things, and I think we knew most of them were stupid in the first place, but think of all those dumbass things that we did, and we called it science at the time.
Well,
it's incredible.
I mean, the idea that if you were walking down the street, the guy across the street could infect you, and you had an airplane, you were okay. How did anybody believe any of that? Because the ventilation system in the airplane was so much better. The funny part, the older planes, the ventilation system was actually better. And one of the reasons that they cut, because they used to allow smoking on planes, remember? Oh, God, was that disgusting. So then I think part of the savings in fuel is that you cut back on the amount of outside air. I mean, for those that I'm not going to give because we got to go to our other guys, but I'm not going to give a thing on HVAC systems, but the bigger percentage of outside air you take in, especially if the outside air is like 40 below like it is around a plane, the more you have to heat it, right? So the more you can recycle, the less heat you have to put in it. So you actually can save energy by having a 20% outside air versus 40 or 45. So I can't imagine if they let people smoke on these new planes what it would feel like. Because I don't think the amount of outside air is anywhere near the same. Do you?
Nope. Anyway, they don't even let you vape, so I don't think we have to worry about it.
Can you do gummies?
I think you get as stoned as you want.
You can't bring on a little airline bottles of booze, but you can bring on gummies. That sucks. What if you like booze better?
I guess you're SOL. Anyway, we should turn this over to my fellow Indiana public school brethren.
Will do.
Brother and sister, and let them weigh in on all the weighty events of the world.
We'll talk at you on Friday, bud.
All right, sounds good.
S&P futures still way up there, 184. NASDAQ futures up 864. So if you're stone cold long this morning, you're having your victory cigar before breakfast, which is fine. Russell, you long spoo?
I'm not. Wow, you really started off with a sore topic.
Oh,
thank
you. I know, we do.
I just want you to know that one of my brightest students yesterday asked me what the hell happened to all the streetcars.
Tore them up.
Yeah. Yeah, I got allowed me to fill 10 minutes of dead time with explaining how GM and the Memphis had a wonderful streetcar system, and they
really
tore it all
was
up.
Was it segregated or no?
Yeah, it was.
Well, that's the best thing you can have.
Dude, I used to, when I was growing up, I actually there was a hamburger place that my dad went to as a kid that still had the separate entrances. They didn't enforce it anymore, but they left it up just kind of like as a historical thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was at the tail end of all that ugliness, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, people that are.
Yeah, the trolley system in Memphis, the tracks actually used to go right by my grandfather's house. But nothing would ever come along when I was a kid. They've ripped them all up, and they've got a huge bike system now. That's what they did with it.
Well,
didn't do anything with it for 40 or 50 years, and then they turned it into I forgot what they call it, the Greenway or something like that. But now you can ride your bike all over Memphis.
See, Chicago had a big system, but if you were like on 63rd Street, the track was just in the middle of there were two tracks, so but if you were in a car, the streetcar could be right behind you. It would have to stop.
Yeah. That's called a bus.
Yeah, it was basically a bus on rails.
Yeah.
So probably
part of how GM, and you know, the flexibility around it, I could see beyond GM bribing a bunch of people. And I told the story that guys, this is the quintessential, overweight, scumbag white guys smoking cigars, making terrible decisions for everybody else. You should have seen all the undergrads' heads nodding up and down as I said that. Like, yeah, they could picture that one.
Well, but if you were segregated, like you were in New Orleans or San Francisco, in a couple spots, just the Market Street one is segregated, I think, then it's it's way better than any kind of bus system. I mean, I suppose it would be the same as if you had, segregated lanes for the buses to go down. Sort of the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever been in Amsterdam?
Yeah.
They have they're sort of segregated, but they have there's the lines for the streetcar, and then and then let's say 8 feet on each side of the tracks, there's yellow lines where you're sort of not supposed to go in there in a car. But if all of a sudden the traffic's horrible, you can go in there and I get right back out. But the streetcar, they all got these little tiny cars over there. The streetcar has a massive rubber bumper in the front of the thing, where if it has to, it can take a car and hit it and shove it out of the way.
I like that. I want that for my car.
Yeah. Well, there's a street that has a, what a gauntlet track is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a street that has all these stores, and it's a pedestrian thing. No cars can go down there. But in the middle, there's a gauntlet track, which means that streetcars from one way or the other can go in, drop people off the stores, pick them up. Then when it exits, it goes off on its track, and the other one comes in from the other way. And it's just a little wider. Each side of the rail, instead of being one rail, there's two. So one of them is on the outside right and inside left, and the other one comes by, and it's the outside left and inside right. So you think there's only one track there. There's actually two. So when one leaves this three-block area, another guy comes in from the other end. So if you're going to shop, you basically can get out in this downtown shopping district, do all your shopping. I mean, if you want to park or drive, you got to go out the other way. It's on the next block or the other way. But in the middle, the main drag, it would be like if State Street was half as wide, and the streetcar just came back and forth and dropped people off. But they still have stores there. But I thought it was pretty darn neat. But that would be me.
Yeah.
These are all electric.
We actually, in Indianapolis, they've got a couple of bus lines that nothing else can drive where those buses are. They're almost like trolleys.
Okay. So it's segregated something.
And they even have like a curb thing that they drive on top of, which makes it impossible for cars to get involved in all that.
All right, so what do you make of today? Positive, negative? I always say positive. You're long.
The smartest oil person that I talk to, or that I say talk to, I maybe talk to four or five times a year, but listen to an awful lot. She's given it 48 hours.
That's probably hopeful.
and I did jump on Kalshi in the prediction markets to see if they had set up a market on, you know, how long the opening lasts. And I haven't seen anything yet, but yeah, I would give it, what's today, Wednesday? I'd give it through the weekend, maybe, at the most. I think I'd be very safe with that.
Well, in terms of degree,
I would be very confident, and you know, I might be talking my book, and I might be talking a bit out of bitterness as well, because I really got caught on the wrong side of this thing badly. But you know, if today were a Friday, I sure wouldn't want to hold it over the weekend.
Well, I think the people that are front running are probably already out.
I don't know. You know, I hadn't checked the move to see if that actually happened this time.
Well, it started to move yesterday afternoon. It was, we were down.
Oh, yeah.
We were down.
Yeah, I mean, I would have, because I know the deadline was last night, I actually thought it was going to go the other way with the deadline.
Well, we were down 50 NASDAQ. No, we were down 100 and some NASDAQ yesterday morning.
Yeah.
And so we started to come back in the afternoon, and I go, all right. We're not going to be bombing. We rolled some of our stuff up. We got some of our stuff that was at the money. We rolled it up a few bucks, which is now is...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now it's kind of useless. I mean, we rolled our Qs, I think, from the 585s to like the 589s, thinking we were slick, and now it's 609. You know, I mean, come on. I'm not a bit startled that this is where we went, because I could see... Russell, you know, the last... 6 months, maybe the last 13 months since certain people took power, I see this every other day. Every announcement is front run. Every single mm-hmm. one. And yesterday, as soon as it started going up, I figured, okay, there's going to be some kind of a stall on this thing. I had no idea it was this kind of degree. You know, mm-hmm. we're talking about 184 points. We're talking, you know, 3.5% in the NASDAQ. You know, we've gone...
Yeah, I mean, this
we've
is...
Gone, we've gone years where we didn't have a 1% move. This is... I think it speaks to what you and I talk about, and I don't know how we can ever explain to people. Matter of fact, I was talking to a couple people last night. One was a retired, owned a carpentry business. The other one's an attorney. And I was starting to explain to them how these moves get so egregious. I said, there's always going to be people that are market makers, just regular mopes like I was, and that I think you came close to being one. You know, We're quarter a half, two up. we're just making a market, minding our own business. All of a sudden, somebody rolls over us. They buy some at a half, some at 5/8, some at 3/4. Show my age using the fractions. And all of a sudden, now we're really short, or the other way, we're really long. And all we're trying to do is be neutral. And now this thing starts running right over our ass. And now we become the bidders, right? Because we got to get this stuff back because we're getting clocked. And all of a sudden, you also have a market where everybody who sees this stuff, the electronic market makers, pull every offer out there. So now there's nothing for us to buy. So instead of, you know, finding our spider, our S&P futures up, you know, even having a bruising day for your behind, up 20 bucks, we're now shagging them back up 150. Well, because it perpetuates itself. The people who can essentially screw the first guys, the first guys now have to turn around and cover themselves, correct? Nobody has any mm-hmm. idea what I'm talking about when I say this, because it's not a natural thing for people to do. But you become the screwy, right? I mean, it happened so many times to me in the OEX pit. Where are you? Quarter 3A, so by 20. Where are you now? Well, I guess I'm at a half. Now I'm at 5A, so now I'm like, I'm not selling you anymore. And all of a sudden, it's $2 higher. Matter of fact, I told my brother yesterday, because we had some calls we could sell in a lot of the stocks we have. We didn't have any calls out there. And I said, and Dan says, well, you know, do we want to have something out here? This volatility is pretty damn high. And I go, well, you know what? If you get them, of course, the markets are widening out too, as you well know. I said, Dan, if you find something you want to sell, if one of these markets narrows up, just sell it. I said, but mm-hmm. here's what I want. You know, it's not like, you know, I tell him what to do. He knows what he's doing. I said, Dan, here's what I mean. I had more experience on the floor than him. I said, Dan, today, rule for today, no standing orders unless it's a spread. There's no way that the market's going to be 55-85 and we're going to say, all right, we'll sell something for Joe, our client, at 75, which seems like a good buy. We're not taking the chance that our 75 is gone and it comes out 2-bid. We're not doing that today. I mean, because mm-hmm. guess what? That's exactly what would have happened, right? That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And I talked to people about the gentleman's agreement that back in the day, everybody says everybody was a crook. They weren't crooks. If Morgan Stanley or somebody come in, Mike Kelly, who's now deceased, Mike Kelly would come in and he'd say, this is the OEX. Sometimes he'd come in at lunchtime and there weren't very many people there. And I was a guy that stood up for whatever. He'll say 75s, and I'll go quarter half. Okay, I'll buy 20. And he goes, and then all of a sudden nobody else is there. And he'll say, I'll pay 3/4. And he buys, 500 at 3/4, which was perfectly legit to do. He didn't have to tell me his size. But then he would turn around and say, Tom, you did yours at 3/4, not at a half. I'm not going to run over you like that. Same way the specialist in IBM, if you had, if you were in the specialist book at 160 and 3/8, trying to sell something there, and now there's some people at a half, some people at 5/8, and somebody walks in and says, where can I buy 100,000 IBM? And the specialist looks at his book, figures out what he's willing to sell, says, you can fill at 3/4. Okay. And he fills at 3/4. You don't take the guy out at 3/8 and then have it come out 3/4 bid. He gets filled at 3/4. None of that is true today. None of that is true. They enjoy running over people, and that's why there's payment for order flow, because that's what you get to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So nobody has any. So the idea of there being some sort of a, if somebody was going to pay $2 for the calls that we had our 10 lot out there at 75 cents, there's no way we're getting filled at $2 today. Where we used to,
right?
We did at a time. If you got filled at $2, you wouldn't be all that unhappy, right? But for the guy to buy it from you and then turn around and sell it to the other guy at $2. Is larceny. It's actually illegal, and yet it happens all the time now, I think. Right?
Yeah, well, the big difference is it's not people standing in a pit that are getting run over. It's people that are posting markets electronically.
Well, yeah, it's
and they're able to adjust a lot quicker and pick up on those things a lot quicker than you would have been able to as a human being.
Well, actually, they pick up on it less because you could see the guy doing it.
Well, they're algos that start to pick up on those types of orders pretty quickly. The iceberg type orders.
Yeah.
And the algos will get out of the way.
Well, yeah, I'm saying
very quickly. Whereas the situation in the pit, it's not moving as quickly. That's for darn sure. But they're able to regardless of how, I've had students say, well, why don't you just piece orders out, and said, because that's they pick up on them, and then the algos start to figure out that there might be some actual size behind some things, and they don't want to be on the other side of that size trade.
Well, it also, it's a funny question when people talk about, most of what Milton Friedman has said has been debunked by now, which is total BS, by the way. But I remember somebody somebody asking him in class. Now this is a 1975 question, 1976. What do you think about insider trading? His answer was, "Don't even try and chase it down. You're never going to chase it down. Just let it go."
There are better things to worry about.
Well, but the reason was, is we had just designed the CBOE at the time, and it was just open. It was an open outcry system, and every trade was done in person. And the broker come in his, because he knew a lot about it, even though that wasn't his area. He knew a lot about a lot of things. He goes, if somebody comes in continually with front running with insider trading, people will stop trading with them. Let the industry discipline themselves. If you have enough competing market makers, he was no fan of the specialist system, because if you have a competing system and everybody can see everybody's face, you don't have to worry about it. It will discipline itself. If the same person, if everybody, I'll use a stupid example. Well, I mean, not stupid. If everybody knows that Trump's kid uses Goldman Sachs, you knew people that, you know, it's always the same big firms, right? And I'm not accusing them, because a lot of times they would get run over by, they used to call it fast money. There was always somebody who knew something. But if all of a sudden, every time IBM's earnings came out, Larissa's the broker for, you know, somebody, somebody, and somebody. She runs in 5 minutes before the IBM earnings, and seeming like she's right three quarters in a row. I got to believe by the next quarter, they're either not trading with her, and I don't think somebody's going to punch Larissa, but they're going to say, get the hell out of here while you still can. I mean, it would become so obvious. But electronically, it's not obvious at all, is it? Plus, they never want to track any of it down.
Well, electronically, if you've got an algo that's throwing things out there, you've got a computer on the other side that can usually figure that out somewhat quickly.
Okay, but it's still not identified. You don't know that the order isn't from the Pakistani who brokered the deal. Right.
No, you're never going to know that.
Yeah. Well,
no. Not, I mean, you would be able to pick up on that when you're on the floor if somebody was, you know, always used the same broker.
Yeah.
But those types of things, that the ability to do that is definitely dissipated somewhat.
Well, you know what's funny on that, and you probably know this, but just for the listeners, a lot of people that were the real fast money that actually had this kind of information, because people sort of always have, it's just a question of who and how good they are at it, they would also demand if you had a real big size, okay, the firms would end up taking, they would demand that the firm took the trade that the market makers didn't want. So maybe at this price, the market makers will do 1,000 and they want to do 2,000, the firm would do the other 1,000. Right.
Yeah.
But if it was real fast money, the firm ended up getting screwed as well as the market makers. So the firms would essentially tell those guys no more. Then they would shift to another firm. they would kind of rotate.
You just see the order come from somebody else.
But then that guy get clocked a couple times, and he didn't want the business anymore either. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like the firm was always at fault. Half the time, the firm was a fellow screwee. Which is,
you know who I would, who if I won one of those lunches with Warren Buffett where you got to, you know, pay $2 or $3 million to charity to go, and I got to slip one question into him, I'd like to know how they were able to do such a good job of working into stocks without people really figuring out they were doing it.
You know, and I
the one thing that I do know around that is that they would use a different broker just about every time they would work into a massive position.
You know what?
And I think if you tipped your hat at all, you were never going to do business with that man again. But other than that, I really don't know. And then I do know, you know, they had the they have a rule where if they were in the process, and this is not just for Buffett, but if they're in the process of building a big position and it's time to report your quarterly positions, you can get an exemption on something if you haven't completed your position yet.
He got some kind of a waiver, because
it's not a waiver. It's just a reporting. I know what you're talking about, and it's just if you're a large firm and you're in the process of building a position, and we've hit a date where you've got to, you're supposed to be reporting your positions, you can you've got an exemption on something. Well, that
when,
you're
when,
working
you say,
into.
When you say you, and I'm gonna.
Well, that's any large firm.
Okay, but I'm
it's
saying,
not just him. It's not just well. See, when you say he got, it's not. I think he may have pushed for it.
Yes, that's
when
what I mean.
When they wanted more transparency, but he's not the only one that takes advantage of it. And there, when he reports her positions, there's a way that you can look at that report and see that they're working into something and they're not fully reporting everything.
The rule was, I think it was called on the trading floor, the Warren Buffett rule.
Because
I'm going to, without knowing my percentages here, it was amazingly simple, Russell. If you could accumulate, I think, up to 5% in the open market, I believe was the number. It wasn't 10. I think it was 5. And as soon as you did that, you were required in like, it was like 72 hours to declare declare your intentions. Is that an F. Scott Rubino filing? Is that what they call it?
I don't know if you still have.
That's my point.
It was that method. But yeah, when you hit 5%, supposedly you now have influence and you have to, and you I don't know if you have to do that anymore.
Well, that's my point. I mean, I think
because I remember that from my buy side days a couple of decades ago. There would be firms that would own 4.9%. And I worked at a hedge fund where we had a big position in a community bank, and we bucked up against that 5% and intentionally stayed under it.
Well,
the company was buying back shares. We had to monitor it really, really closely.
Well, the deal was, and again, this is foggy ago. It was very simple. When you got to that number, you had to tell people your intentions. If your intentions were to
you have a controlling interest, and are you going to be passive or active?
Well, no. Well, it had to be more than that. Is my intention to take it over?
What I mean by active.
But is my intention to go to 7% and never buy another share? You could have done that too. You just had to tell people. And Buffett decided that wasn't good enough for him. Okay, so maybe because he was also getting shares not through the market for companies that weren't doing so hot, you know. It became the Warren Buffett rule, where I don't exactly know how you get around it, but he was able to get more stock than the original 5% was the bottom line. I got a great story on that. We'll go to break though first. The S&P futures up 176. It's actually down a little bit. They're up 180, but it's still pretty darn high. The NASDAQ futures up 829. I'm going to say, Russell, it's a record in my era. I've never seen.
Gee whiz! I can remember when the Nasdaq was at 829.
I know. Yeah,
I just got it.
It's only that it's up that much today. We'll be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now. Right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. Andrew, we might want to keep this one for the archives because we're never going to see one like this again. SP futures up 176. Well, I won't say never, but it'll be a while. NASDAQ futures up 827. Dow futures up 1100. This is down a little bit from where they were, which is even crazier. I don't see anything. Oh yeah, dude. There's one red Chevron because oil's way down. And what else? Verizon's down like 60 cents. Other than that, the entire page is green. Crazy stuff over in Europe. We've got the DAX up 1,200. That's 5%. FTSE up 309. That's 3%. CAC around up 382, that's 5%. So everybody's awash in oil, and they're all happy. Asia Nikkei up 2,800, that's 5%. Hang Seng up 776, that's 3%. Shanghai up 104, that's almost 3%. So, yippee! Bonds, however, down 10 basis points, 4.23. But the 10-year is still 4.23. I don't know. Yields fall sharply, but the amount of money we've spent on this, I think we still got problems on these interest rates. Matter of fact, who knows? Maybe today.
I'll tell you that nothing has changed with the Fed odds, and nothing has changed with the European.
Absolutely. Blend down 16, 2.91. Oil, big move here, down $18, 94.33, but still 94. Brent down 16, 92.99. Natural gas down 9 cents, 277. RBOB, under $3, 296, down 33 cents. Gold is up 113, 47.98. Silver up 470, which is a big move in there. That's 6%. 76.70. Copper up 17 cents, so everything's up. Foreign exchange, dollars, of course, down, as you might examine. The euro is up to 117. It was, for God's sake, it was like 115.5 yesterday. So that's like a 1% move. And Russell's going to explain to us what a 1% move in currencies does if you're on the wrong side of that. British pound up is almost 135. It was 133-something yesterday. Yikes. Crypto up 3,100, not, or 3,100. Not sure how this affects crypto, but it does. Everybody's buying everything. 71,875. Yeah, Andrew, what do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is 7:35 here in Chicago on Wednesday, April 8th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Cubs won over the Rays 9-2. And weather is looking all right today. It's currently 39 degrees, but it's going to warm up a whole bunch up to 66 degrees. We're going to have basically some showers in the morning, very early morning, some showers in the very late night. Otherwise, going to be overcast and windy throughout the rest of the day. Over in Phoenix, they're keeping it warm and clear. They're currently at 68 degrees, and they're going to have a high of 98. Finally, for Chicago traffic, I was going to say things were looking okay, but I think literally in the past 5 minutes, the average travel time rose about 5 minutes for each inbound expressway. So if you're on the Kennedy going to Montrose, it'll take you 27 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 41 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 44. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 32 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 43 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
The Russell, I got a quick story about that. When I first got on the trading floor and I was up on my brown badge up in the balcony, right, and wasn't really on the main floor. So all of a sudden, you could sort of hear the commotion, right? One of the stacks, ABC, starts running up one day. Out of the blue, it starts running up. The market hadn't gone up in ages. And this one stack starts flying up. American Broadcasting Company, ABC. And nobody could figure out what the hell was happening. Somebody was buying it. Well, it turns out, you found out later, because you didn't, it ran up like on a Tuesday, and the next day everybody's waiting for this filing you and I were talking about, and there wasn't one. And all of a sudden the stock ran right back down again. And everybody's going, what the bleep, over? It turns out it was Howard Hughes, back when he was decrepit up, staying, where did he stay? Was he the Dunes or the Desert Inn? He had the top floor. There was a guy, I really want to read about a really strange duck. It's Howard Hughes. He was a brilliant kind of inventor, aerospace guy, Mormon. He was. And he ends up deciding to become some sort of a recluse where he ran his entire operation from the penthouse of one of these hotels. I don't know if it was the Dunes or the Desert Inn, because he owned the Dunes, the Desert Inn, the Castaways. He owned like five hotels in Vegas. Other than the mob, he was the biggest owner out there. So he was his germophile. So people have to put on paper towels. He walked to the bathroom. But he like never cut his toenails, never let me look at his teeth. His teeth were hanging out of his mouth. It was disgusting. The guy who worked for him never saw him. The Mormon guys who took care of him upstairs would bring him handwritten notes downstairs. And one day, he gets this thing, we want to buy ABC. So he goes out and starts buying ABC. The guy had nothing but money. He was still today, there's a huge company. And next day, they said, sell it. And he's like, what the hell? It turns out, Hughes was like, damn near a serial racist. He hated black people. For whatever reason, I have no idea. So he wants to buy ABC. And in the afternoon, he's watching The Dating Game. And there was a guy that was on there that, three girls were, one of them was going to get the date with this guy. Well, the guy, he was, I don't know if he was Italian or what he was, but he had reasonably dark skin. So Howard Hughes thought that this station actually set up a white girl with a black guy. You know, this is a long time ago. And decided he didn't want to own any station that was like that. And so the next day he told the guy to sell his stuff. Do you believe that? That's absolutely true.
You know, it was his money.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
what a he's you know, they're you know, Mr. Burns on The Simpsons is a little bit of a parody of him.
Oh, really?
Just okay. Being absolutely crazy and then having you know, a fellow that's takes care of all of his needs.
Well, the one lady that he dated, because I mean he used to date everybody. He's a real good looking guy.
Oh God, he hooked up with half of Hollywood.
Well, and one of the ladies said he was such a horrible racist. If he saw a black guy in fire, he wouldn't even piss on him. Jesus,
he was.
Yeah, that's pretty. That's, anyway,
what, he lived at the Desert Inn.
Desert Inn, okay.
Yeah, which I thought was flat. I didn't realize there was a tower part to it, but I think that's because there was a terrible show in the 70s about a detective that lived at the Desert Inn. I can't remember.
A lot of guys from the floor used to go there because they were one of the places on the strip that actually had a golf course. So if you so guys would go and stay and you know, play golf. It was a nice place. I mean, now it's I'm not sure what's there now, but it was down on
I think it's been imploded.
Oh yeah, and it's one of the new places. Yeah. I mean, the golf course is now part of a new hotel. The place that had the golf course is where the Tropicana had one. That's now some other place. Mm-hmm. That's where MGM is now. It's where the Tropicana golf course used to be. Anyway, but we talked about one of the characters in American history, huh? That guy. He got all his money by what did they invent? They had a what was Hughes Tool famous for?
He was heavily interested in you know, in aircraft, but I don't know how he made his money. I just know he was cray cray, and he was also, you know, I was a little kid when he died, and they fought over, you know, his there were like 15 wills out there, and
yeah,
that kind of stuff. That's more of my memory of him was, you know,
I wonder if those things were ever settled.
They had to have been somehow.
You would think.
Or, you know, the government took it.
Howard Hughes made his fortune primarily by inheriting and expanding the... I knew he inherited it, the Hughes Tool Company, which monopolized the oil drilling industry with a revolutionary... Yeah. You know what they did? I remember this. They had a two-cone roller bit.
So yeah, they had a cool drill bit.
It went one way and then the other, so the dirt didn't build up and wreck the bit somehow.
Yeah. They came up with a way that they didn't snap off or whatever when they got way down there.
I think he owned TWA for a while too, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway,
he also owned the Spruce Goose.
Yeah.
That's how I always remember that. Gigantic plane, got about 20 feet off the ground, never really flew again.
And it's still sitting in Long Beach, still in the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, okay, so here we are. We've got the 10-year down a little bit today. The administration just came out with their budget for next year, and on defense, they want another 40%. They're never going to raise taxes. I don't know how much more they can borrow. Interesting to see the CPI number on Friday, which I hope it doesn't, but it could take this market exactly the opposite direction.
You think? Well, I was gearing up for that one, but now you can just basically say that, well, March is going to be a one-off because the war's over. So you can, even if we, and they're looking for a 1% month over month CPI, even if we get that, you know, you can discount it as long as the Straits continues to be open and all that other kind of stuff.
Remember the line in The Natural? Where he said, I got lucky, and the girl said, I know better. The idea that if oil prices come down, that it's going to stop the inflation spiral when we're doing...
It's too late for that.
It's
going to take months to get everything back to normal.
I'm going
to
say my friend Russell knows better. It's not... Oil is the whipping boy here, but if the money supply keeps going up at an 11% rate like it's doing now, it doesn't matter what happens to the oil.
Yeah.
How many people know that?
I don't think people realize that it's just not like flipping a switch. I don't think that. I think what you'll have is you'll have this frustration in about a month when filling up your tank is still very expensive relative to what it was a couple of months ago. Why didn't it come back down? The war's over. Well, it's not that simple.
No, but the general inflation is not because of oil, even though people think it is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's we got more money chasing everything around.
Hey, have you, I know you, yeah. you and Larissa are teaching the youth of the world. Have you had a chance to listen in on any of Hal's stuff lately, or have you read any stuff that I sent out to you guys?
I've scanned over it. You know, we're both at a pretty busy time of the year.
I know, he started, I mean, we've all been sort of talking about not only the interest rates, what they've been doing in the last, I mean, we've been on the show together for a while. We've talked about this for kind of a long time. And that these drop in interest rates, even though a bunch of giggly people on TV talk about how it's benefiting everybody, the simple fact is it only seems to benefit a few people. Have you, and Hal started talking a while ago, I mean, Hal's a brilliant guy, and he goes kind of off on sort of these tangents, and I got to reel him back a little bit. But he started talking about maybe six, 9 months ago that some of the stuff that's actually in the banking system with some of the rules and regs and this changeover that you and I have just kind of sort of talked about, the fact that they're all the borrowing in the system used to be from bank to bank. Hence it was the Fed funds rate.
Yeah.
And if anybody either borrowed from the Fed or actually deposited money back at the Fed, it was kind of it didn't used to happen. I mean, there was kind of no M0, which is funds put back at the Fed overnight where the Fed pays interest. And Hal picked up on this very early about this is kind of changing the world, the fact that these guys are paying interest to drag money out, which is not really the same as just money supply, how much is in the pool. And as time has gone by, he's continued to refine this to the point where he gave some big presentation at Auburn University a couple of weeks ago, and I guess he was very well received, where it has to do with changes in the banking regulations from 2000 and again 2008 have sort of caused you and I, and Larissa to a certain extent, have talked about, okay, they could lower the rates from, you know, 4.5, wherever the hell they are now, down to 1, and it wouldn't affect us on credit cards 1 iota, which is really screwed up when you think about it. He's kind of tied through all these regulations and how they're putting so much money into the system so that some preferred borrowers are able to take advantage of it. But at the same time, they put all these regulations in against really lending to the plumbing company, or it's harder for us, you and I, to get a loan for an addition to our house, and we're paying more than the other guys. And he says the way they're doing this is by raising the interest rate, so they're actually putting the money in the system for some people to take advantage of and then dragging it back out so sort of other people can't. And he's talking about the places where you get the big bubbles are in margin interest on stock, margin lending, because they're going to let that happen because they want the stock market going up. That you look at these very few spots where the actual money is going. It's going to people that are buying baseball teams. It's going to mergers and acquisitions to the extent there are a lot lately. There haven't been a lot. He goes, it's actually between the regulations and the new way of handling it, it really is only pushing money into the hands of the richest people and not the other people. And he's gotten more into this like every month to the point where I don't think he's on a tangent anymore. I think he's got something.
I mean, I can totally see that, and we know that the way things work with respect to inflation is that it inflates asset prices, and that does help the high end more than the low end. And this ends up resulting in that K-shaped economy thing that Larissa and I have talked about, and even done videos on now. You know, where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. I can remember my mom saying that an awful lot.
But I never put two and two together to what he's saying. Where he said the other day, look at it. Somebody sends in $100,000 to PTI Securities or Merrill Lynch. Notice how I put it in the same sentence, and wants to buy $200,000 worth of stock. Because that guy gets a loan in a nanosecond. If you put up $100,000 for a plumbing company and want to borrow $100,000, you're not getting that loan.
No.
I never thought, Russell, that there was some. It's just the way it is. I never thought about it, but now he's making me think about it, and I'm going, God, that is kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's just, but you know, the people that maybe have money to invest in stocks, they probably think of them as a better risk than someone who, wants to start up a plumbing company or something like that.
Well, but the idea, yeah, is,
and then you've got a tangible security you can go after as well, whereas you can't necessarily keep up with how the guy's business is doing.
Well, okay, but the tangible security is yet another. Mm-hmm. It is, because it has been for a while, right? I mean, today.
Yeah.
If you would have sold some futures last night, and put a stop in, where would you have gotten filled? Where's the tangible? You wouldn't have got filled in your stop price.
Oh, probably not. No.
So I mean, but who's to say that the I'll pick a stock here. I mean, you know, I'm not giving any market advice. UAL is $100. I mean, who's to say that you just give somebody a $50,000 loan and 1,000 shares of UAL is $100,000, right? $100. So okay, so you send $50,000 to PTI Securities. Who's to say that tomorrow UAL doesn't open up at 25? I mean, it hasn't happened in like a really long time, and hopefully it never does. But it's not like there's no risk in UAL and there's only risk in a plumbing company. I mean, you can...
Right, but the risk in UAL is a lot more transparent than the risk in the plumbing company.
But it's predicated on the hypothesis that as you get down to 30%, which means UAL drops to, say, 85 or 80, to where now the 50% you sent PTI is now 30 and we call you up, it's predicated on the hypothesis it's going to happen gradually enough to we're going to catch it before the 30, yeah. And you're going to say, I can't send you any more money, and we're going to say, well, guess what? We got to start selling it, and we're going to sell 100 shares today or 200 shares today, and we're going to have to do that for you. I mean, that's we haven't had to do that for people in God knows how long. But it isn't to say that it'll never happen, right? It's an assumption that whatever we've had going for many years is going to keep going, and it's somehow inherently the stock market is less risky than a plumbing company. And I don't know that that's necessarily an assumption we could rigorously defend.
It's not how risky it is, it's how transparent it is and how easy it is to keep up with.
Right. It is until...
Yeah, you're not going to know... Okay, if I make a loan for you to go buy some stock, and the stock loses 10% one day, I know in a day that there's trouble with UAL.
Yep.
If I make a loan to, you know, the guy that just redid my bathroom here in Indianapolis... let's say I make a loan to him so he can expand his remodeling business, and instead he takes the loan and he disappears to Hawaii or something like that. It's probably going to take me a couple of months to figure out that there's a real problem after he's missed a couple of payments.
Yep, I get it.
So there is the risk difference there is the information thing, and it's why companies go public.
Well, but it's also
people are more willing to lend money to a company that has been public for a few years and has that auditable track record out there. So, and it's the same thing with lending money to people that want to buy the stock.
Right,
Larissa?
It is right.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I didn't want to get you to say something. Larissa and I were sitting here texting going, how long before Chief calls on her?
I didn't know she was.
And
how would I know?
You made it 53 minutes.
Well, the part that you never mentioned to, I don't know who's on. I don't get that feed.
Your producer is not whispering in your ear?
No.
Now your producer hates me too.
I said to you a half hour ago, I'm very disappointed Larissa's not here. He didn't say anything.
I didn't hear that. Did you hear that, Larissa?
I didn't hear that.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that either.
I said, where's Larissa when we need her?
Yeah.
Which is most of the time. Anyway, Larissa, what are you thinking about this, the stuff that Hal's been doing? Where he's coming to the point with this is the areas where it's so much easier to borrow, meaning the stock market, seemingly you'll lend anybody any amount of money for a baseball or football team. Because you'll see in those areas the prices have gone up because of – the fact that it's so easy to borrow, that maybe because of that, the stock market might actually be in a place someday where it's ridiculously high and has this huge vulnerability. I mean, he's building these papers on this stuff, and I'm starting to catch there's some logic to it. I don't know where.
Well, there is. I think there's some logic to it. I'm not totally disagreeing with that.
But I
understand it as well.
Yeah. Well, when you guys do it, that's why I'm running it by you, because when he first started it, I didn't really understand it, because I knew my Fed guys introduced me to the concept of M0, which I never knew what that was. Did you guys know that before I did? You know, is M1 and M2?
What is M0?
M0 is the amount of money that is in circulation that's given back to the Fed at night that they pay interest on.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't either.
I didn't know you could make interest by giving money to the Fed.
Well, that's what held the basis of all this, is the Fed is putting money out there at ridiculously high rates in terms of 11% money supply growth we're pushing now. But then after some people get to use it, they're then dragging it back at night and paying banks interest overnight and essentially drawing it back out of the system, which they never used to do. This is something new. And it was the Bank Act of 2008 or something that kind of allows them to do this. And that's why your Fed funds rate is kind of non-existent now, because people just put the money right back to the Fed and they're paying interest on it, which is kind of weird, because the interest is like higher than if we went in and got a checking account today. If we're lucky, we're going to get what, 1%? Well, that,
oh no,
I'm not talking about a CD, I'm talking about a checking account.
No, I am too. I think it'd be lower than that.
Okay, so those banks are then turning around and just giving it back to the Fed at night for more than the 1%. They don't even have to make any loans.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird. I wish I knew more about it. I wish my guys...
Well, the Fed has taken on the role of... it used to be the banks would do this among themselves.
Yeah.
And when things started to lock up around 2008, that's when they allowed Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs to become banks so that they could... be involved in the overnight lending situation.
What happens to the money from like the exchanges that now have an open portal to the Fed?
I think it's the same thing. I think if they want to lend or borrow overnight, that's who they utilize.
Larissa,
it's the clearinghouses. It's not the exchanges, but
yeah, Larissa. What's in today's world? Have you ever seen a move like this in the market? And what do you think? Is it sustainable?
I don't think it's sustainable. I hope it's not sustainable. I'm a little more contrarian, and I'm very fearful that when the market does correct, it'll be a much larger correction. So, yep.
What do you think? If that happens, what do you think the cause is?
What the catalyst will be?
Yeah, my vote would be for interest, long term interest rates, but it doesn't seem to ever want to happen. But what would your catalyst be?
Right now, I think we're starting to see movement in the private equity. I also think that it's going to move over to insurance. I think a lot of these assets are overpriced, and we're going to start to see some defaults there. And I think it'll be different. It won't have that huge crash like we did in 2008 or 1987, but it'll be more like the dot-com bubble, where we had these miniature crashes, and it will eventually erode the entire market.
Listen, I'm with you on that. Russell and I, long before I knew you, back before Larissa, not as good a time. I like it now better when I know you. Russell and I used to talk a lot about all these property companies going under in China and how dangerous that was, and somehow or another, I don't know, is the market going up kind of salved all that over? All of a sudden, nobody even talks about it anymore, but there still has to have been a lot of people that have lost money. There's got to be a lot of people in commercial real estate, especially in Chicago, that have gotten their ass kicked. Yet it never seems... Do you think the private equity is just another thing, that if the market keeps going up, it just all get absorbed, or it actually is going to mean something this time?
I think it will eventually start to mean something.
Why do you suppose the China situation never reared its ugly head, Russell?
I don't think we're done with that.
Okay.
I think they keep pushing it down the road, but things are not getting particularly better over there. Their property market is an absolute nightmare. They keep and I learned a bit more about that last night. You know, a lot of people make payments on that you basically make a down payment and they start building the house for you or the condo for you. And there are people that are making mortgage payments and still making mortgage payments on homes that they're probably never going to receive. And I've always wondered why. Well, apparently, it's not like walking away here in the United States. You know, I know more than one person that was underwater on their house in, you know, 2006, 7, and 8 and walked away from it and have recovered since. You know, they did the bankruptcy thing. And it's not, and I even tell my students, I said, it's not ideal, but don't let financial institutions scare you into, you know, not biting the bullet and trying to start over at some point.
Well, how does the average guy in China afford two mortgages?
So the thing in China is apparently once you've signed up for these things, if you try to walk away, they start coming after everything else you have. The repercussions from the bank. So let's say, you know, let's say I own a Tesla over there and I made a down payment on a house and I stopped making that mortgage payment. They can come for my car.
Wow.
Yeah, I got a question answered last night while digging into this. So I think that's why their property market hasn't blown up like it did here. And they've been in a property recession for 5 years.
Well, how many people in China can afford two mortgages?
I think they just force it on you. I don't think anybody can afford anything over there.
Well, there's a lot of people here.
I mean, there's been deflation in salaries. It's just kind of silly, but you know, when you have a very controlled economy, things can be bad for a very, very long time before it really catches up with you. And think about the Soviet Union into the 80s. How long do you think things were crappy economically for them before it finally cracked?
A
decade?
You've been there, right? I've never been there.
I never got a chance to go there. I had a chance to go with John and Pete, and I turned it down, and I wish I hadn't.
I don't know.
They were just really, really busy, and I had a chance to sneak on a plane with them and go over there, and I wish I had.
That would have been cool.
Yeah.
Larissa, do you know anybody, I do, through family, that are still paying mortgages in Florida on places that have not been repaired since the hurricane and can't live there?
No, I don't know anybody like that.
Because, I mean, I think you have to keep paying. I mean, if you have equity, you keep paying. If you don't have equity, you can walk, basically.
But yeah, you just walk away from it.
If you have equity, I don't know if you can.
And I, you know, just to what's the catalyst going to be? There's going to be some sort of debt situation.
Yeah,
Deutsche Bank, who has not been the strongest bank in the world, just had some really good earnings. And part of it was based on, and I'd love to know how they technically did this, they shorted software company loans and made a couple hundred million in the first quarter.
Oh, really?
Private lending's biggest exposure is software.
Well, Larissa, we got to dash here pretty soon, and we'll talk to you more. By the way, Lou is out the next couple of weeks, so if somebody has some spare time early on a Thursday next 2 weeks, it would be nice to have them. I know you guys are busy. But hey, what happens, just the building across the street, or 175, Russell, I don't know if I told you this. Mm-hmm. The people bought it for $200 million. They had a note for $165 a year or two ago, maybe more than that with the COVID. They essentially punted it to the bank and said, it's yours. Well, now, according to Cranes, they basically puked that out to somebody for like $30 million or $32 million or something. Where exactly does the $130 million hit? It's not like a bank here that owns, it's not like it's Continental Bank owns a mortgage anymore. Is this part of the private equity group that you're talking about, Larissa? I mean, how do we even figure out who the people are that just took this $130 million hit?
You know, I don't know how they, how those people are found out. And Russell, do you know?
Well, that's part of the, I mean, that's part of the issue with analyzing these things is it's much like trying to figure out what's going on at a hedge fund when they don't have to share all of their positions.
So you
but
think,
it just the areas of the private lending market that we're aware of are like the firms like Blackstone that have been doing some of this lending, and you know, they're a bit more transparent about it.
Well, if we got a dash here, but if somebody was going to buy that, say we were going to buy the building at 230 and we had 70 to put down, and we're going to go borrow 160, you don't just go to a bank anymore. I know that. I mean, at least I think I know mm-hmm. that. Who do you get to cobble together all the people to come up with the other 160? Is that? I don't even know what that job is. Is there some kind of an accumulator of this stuff? I mean, who does that?
I would assume that there are, you know, entities to put together. You know, much like when a company goes public and 15 firms are involved in you know, placing the shares. I assume that there's a syndicate situation like that as well.
Well, I get all these emails.
It's just not, you know, it's just because, you know, when you're talking about the syndicate and issuing shares, that's a very public process. The private lending market is not necessarily as transparent, but it's getting bigger. And basically the private lending market is kind of like the lowest end of the mortgage lending market back in the day.
Well, I get these emails.
So that's why we think that's where, and I think it's like a collective we, because she and I have been talking about it. But I think that's why we think that's where the problems are going to pop up.
Well, I get these emails from somebody saying, you know, Joe from somebody and somebody.
That's a scam.
Okay, because they'll have a picture.
They're trying to scam you. Don't borrow money from those people.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about borrowing. They're saying there's a building in Tulsa that's going up and it's 15 stories and they're looking for people to put the loan together and blah, blah, blah.
Why would you do that?
I wouldn't, but I'm saying...
And the other thing is, and this goes back to Larissa and I on the YouTube channel that we do. We did a thing about 6 months ago about how private equity is really not, and because it's being offered in ETFs now, that is really not appropriate for individuals. And... if you take it a step further, if private equity is so freaking great, why are people packaging it into an ETF and selling it to individuals?
Well, do the private equity firms, Lewis, yep. is probably a question for her, and the last question, are the banks now lending to these places? Is that's where the bank liability is coming in?
No.
Yeah. Sorry, go on, Russell.
No, it's funds that have raised capital from investors that turn around and make... you know, low quality, high yielding loans.
But why is
like an insurance company handing over, you know, $250 million to a Blackstone and saying, you know, go out and lend it and make 8-9% for us on loans. And you know, if you're going to be lending to people that are willing to pay an 8 or 9% rate, those are low quality loans.
Well, why is
and
Jamie-
you get any slowing in the economy at all? You know, heaven forbid we get a COVID situation. That would decimate the private lending market.
Well, why,
right there?
But why, Jamie Dimon seemed to indicate that there's been some lending from his bank to these people too. There's some liability.
They all have some exposure.
Okay,
but the overall exposure, just to not leave this as the most negative thing in the world, as a percentage of the financial markets, it's nothing compared to what the mortgage lending was as a percentage of the financial markets back in 2008.
Okay, fair enough.
So it can be a problem, but not, and that's why, you know, Larissa was saying, you know, maybe a 20% correction, but not, you know, a catastrophe here.
All right. Well, we're up 3.5% today, so we could get out three today, right back where we started from. Thank you.
I think we're going to finish the day unchanged.
Oh God. what would that look like on a chart? Good Lord.
That would be a big old red bar, wouldn't it, Larissa?
It would.
The author of Candlestick Charting for Dummies, the third edition.
That would drive me to drink. And I would do that. Anyway, Larissa, take care of yourself. Sorry to get you earlier. Right? We'll make up for that next week. Again, if you guys are this Thursday or next Thursday, if you got some time, let me know, because Lou is out of country someplace. I don't know where. He's got stuff going. We'll find out all about it when he gets back. SP Futures up 178, NASDAQ Futures 859. We really haven't budged from this number in 2 hours. So we're happy here right now. We'll be right back tomorrow morning. Stocks and Jocks.
Thank you. Good morning.
That's all, folks.